Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Ralph Cutter, and he'll be answering your most important questions on fish food. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we are broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Ralph a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be sold or distributed in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Ralph Cutter about fish food. This segment of our show is brought to you by the Orvis Company, makers of fly rods in the USA since 1856, and still on the cutting edge with their award-winning Helos fly rods. Check out their premium quality flies like Copper Johns, Beadhead Princes, and Elk Hair Caddis for only $1.50 each at www.orvis.com/flies. That's www.orvis.com/flies. Fill your fly box this season at an incredible price. Find out more about all the great fly fishing products Orvis has at www.orvis.com. That's www.orvis.com. Before we introduce Ralph, I'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Ralph's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Ralph's book, Fish Food, courtesy of Stackpole Books. To find out more about the books that Stackpole publishes, you can go to their website at www.stackpolebooks.com. Stackpolebooks.com. And we're also going to be giving away another one of his books, Sierra Trout Guide, courtesy of Frank Amato Publications. And to find out more about the Frank Amato Publications, go to www.amatobooks.com. That's amatobooks.com. So here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. And the question will be something that we talk about during the show. You must submit your answer along with your name and location in the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills and see if you don't win one of Ralph's great books. Tonight, our guest is Ralph Cutter. For the past 30 years, Ralph and his wife, Lisa, have run the California School of Fly Fishing. In pursuit of trout, they have logged well over 4,000 miles throughout the High Sierra backcountry. They have guided and hosted trips in Alaska, Mexico, Belize, and Peru. They recently returned from a scientific expedition in Papua New Guinea, where they lived for a month and documented fish species in never-before-explored jungle caldera. Ralph has written hundreds of articles and contributed over a dozen books on fly fishing and aquatic ecology. His book, Sierra Trout Guide, has sold over 70,000 copies, and another book, Fish Food, is one of Stackpole Books' bestsellers. He's a columnist for the California Fly Fisher magazine and past editor of Fly Fishing in the West and Adventure West magazines. Cutter's produced and filmed the video, Bugs of the Underworld, which won numerous international awards and has been the top-selling video in its class 3 years running. Ralph and Lisa were instrumental in the discovery of the first new trout species described in the past 6 decades. It was discovered in the remote Sierra Madre backcountry of central Mexico, and of course, it was caught on a fly. The Cutters are ardent conservationists and life members of Trout Unlimited. Ralph and Lisa are inducted into the Federation of Fly Fishers Hall of Fame in 2000. Ralph, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Hey, good evening, Roger.
Well, good to have you on board here, and we kind of got, you know, shot out of the water, so to speak, last June, but we're back. And tonight, everything's just going really smooth. I better knock on wood, huh? You never know. But we got lots of questions because we had questions from the first round, and then some more new questions came in the past couple of days, so we've got lots of work to do tonight, and I guess we better get started here. We're kind of building the show around your book, Fish Food, and in that book, you kind of dug deep, so to speak, into a lot of the food that's available to the trout. And can you kind of, you know, I mean, there were a lot of books about fish food, per se, out there, but why did you write Fish Food, and how was your approach different than what you'd seen on the market already out there?
Well, Fish Food, I didn't mean to write Fish Food. It just kind of happened. I've spent most of my life, my adult life, swimming underwater, watching fish, watching the foods that fish eat, watching how fish react to their foods, watch how fish react to presentations, different kinds of flies. And what I found out very early on and only learned it better and better and more as time went on is that a lot of the stuff that you read in the magazine articles or in the books just isn't true. I mean, there are just a million myths, legends, and lies out there, and it seems like one book is just paraphrasing the last book, which is paraphrasing the last book, which goes back to, you know, Lee Wolf's time saying that trout do this and bugs do that, and that flat out is not what I was seeing underwater. So I was determined to just, you know, write these little essays about what I was seeing, let the world know. And those first came out as columns in California Fly Fisher magazine, and Backpole out of the blue called up and said, we want to buy those from you for second publication rights. And I said, sure, that's easy. That's how it came about.
That's how it came about. Well, good. Well, in the book, you cover all kinds of insects, and as well as bait fish, crustaceans, amphibians, and mammals. What do trout eat the most of?
Boy, I get that question all the time, and the answer is it depends. And I imagine that in the next hour and a half, that's probably going to be the phrase I say the most, it depends. You know, if you're a trout living in the foothill streams here in California, you know, depending on the seasonality, salmon eggs might be the only thing you're going to eat for 3 months. I mean, that's all you want. And then you're going to be eating baby salmon as they come out of the reds. And maybe as those eggs are being laid, the first thing you're going to be eating are all the bugs that are dislodged by the spawning salmon. But at the same period, if you go to the Missouri, you know, in Montana, they're probably going to be eating betas or midges. And if you go to, you know, some other place, that, you know, the middle American, they're going to be eating, old, you know, sculpins and smelt and maybe mice. So I don't think trout eat most of anything, you know, can be given as a broad stroke across this country. It just happens to be the time of the year and where they happen to be.
And I suppose, too, the size of the fish.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. You know, little fish typically eat little bugs, and as they get bigger, they eat bigger bugs, and then, you know, at least around here, when they get to about 12 or 13 inches, they really convert to crayfish and eating other fish. So it really does depend on, you know, where they live, how big they are, and what's happening, you know, depending on the season and the terrain.
John in New Jersey says, Ralph, I highly recommend your DVD to all my students. In your opinion, would you say midges are the most important food source, or would it depend on the region of the country?
You know, that dovetails right back to your last question. Down on the lower Yuba here, midges are relatively unimportant. I mean, there are midges out there, but there's a lot more nutritious things to eat. But in some of the high mountain lakes and the Rockies and the Sierra, the only reason that trout exist is because there are midges. They're ubiquitous. You're going to find them in every body of water that you find trout. So in that regard, yeah, they could be considered one of the most important or widespread food forms, but I would hate to go out on a limb and say that they are the most important food, because in some waters they probably rarely, if ever, get eaten.
Right, right. Again, it depends, right?
So yeah, it depends.
James in Sacramento says, are certain trout species more discriminating on what they choose to eat, feeding on only a very limited selection of insects, crustaceans, or small fish, or are all trout opportunistic feeders?
I think all trout will eat whatever they can wrap their lips around. You know, they'll become very specific feeders if they have a lot of food and it's easy to get. And as the food becomes scarce, you know, based on seasonality or topography or elevation, they're going to become less and less selective and become increasingly opportunistic. And I don't think any species of trout just by its, you know, its genetics is any more inclined to be less or more opportunistic or selective in its feeding.
Okay. John in Pleasanton, California says, do trout really eat 90% of their food subsurface? How does the time of year make a difference in their eating habits? Example, do trout eat more on the top water during the summer months and less on the surface during the winter months?
I'll answer the second half first. Do they eat more on top water during the summer than on the winter? It depends. I think if there are a lot of bugs coming out, a lot of bugs hatching, they're going to tend to drift to the surface because all those bugs, as they hatch, they swim from the bottom. You know, one's going to leave now, one's going to leave the bottom in 3 seconds, another one's going to leave the bottom in a minute. But they all collect at the surface. And so that's the easiest place for trout to get all these bugs. You know, instead of chasing them all around the river, just wait at the surface and collect them. You know, let the surface tension grab them and then just slip them off there. So in the middle of winter, you can have really good surface activity on betas and blue-winged olives, betas or blue-winged olives, same thing, or midges. And then, of course, the summer, we have all the summer hatches. So it depends on your stream. If you've got a pretty sparse insect population in your stream, perhaps the best topwater fishing is going to be in the winter when they're eating, you know, the little betas and the little midges. But, you know, most trout streams, I would say most of the surface feeding is going to be in May, June, and early July.
And then you have the terrestrial activity in August and September.
Yeah, but you know, most of the terrestrials get eaten underwater, I'm convinced. We like fishing floating grasshoppers and floating ants and things and have the trout blast them, but we did an experiment just a few weeks ago where we took a hopper pattern and drifted it over a run. I don't know how many times Lisa drifted it, and I was underwater with video gear. I think we got one or two kind of false rises. The fish would come inspect it, but the second she put a split shot on it, she got bit like 5 out of the first 6 drifts.
Really?
So, yeah, terrestrials, people fish them on the surface way too much. And I shouldn't say way too much because it's so much more fun. Maybe it's worth getting, you know, 20%, you know, fewer fish, but having a lot more visual and fun on it.
Right, right. Yeah, because, gosh, nobody thinks, you know, I mean, and most of the hoppers are designed to float.
Yeah, and that's not to their advantage. It's, you know, it's great for floating a little nymph or something underneath it, and it's great because they're easy to tie, and it's great because they're fun to watch. And, you know, especially the foam hoppers, they never sink. It's just a maintenance-free fly. But, you know, if you really want to make it more effective, sink it.
Yeah, interesting. That might be one of the best tips of the night right there. And this is all tying into the same thing. Jim in Jefferson City, Missouri, says, based on your observations, about what percentage of the time do trout feed opportunistically and what percentage of the time do they feed selectively?
Well, you know, on a river, a freestone river like the Truckee or the Pitt, you know, the McLeod, those fish rarely get selective. There just isn't enough of the same amount of food running down the dinner plate there for them to decide they're only going to eat one thing. But if you go to the Spring Creeks, you go to Silver Creek or Hat Creek or Fall River or Hot Creek, where you have just a prolific hatches of, say, PMDs and then trichos and then this and then that, those fish are going to get really, really selective a lot quicker than they will be on a river like the Truckee where, you know, they don't see the same thing over and over and over again. So it depends. It really depends on the creek itself. On some creeks, I would say, you know, the really rich spring creeks, perhaps 60% of the time they get very, very selective. And in a place like the Truckee, probably 5% of the time.
Well, I know we did an interview recently with Tom Rosenbauer on fishing small streams, and he was talking about, you know, the fish in those streams are very opportunistic, more so than anything else, because they don't have the hatches and so forth.
Exactly.
So they're looking at anything that's floating and taking a taste, you know. So.
Yeah, and you hit it on the head. You said anything that's floating. I say anything that's drifting, they'll take a taste. When you get down there with these guys and you see what they put in their mouths, you just have to slap yourself on the head and be embarrassed that you can't catch more fish because they're eating sticks, they're eating gravel, they're eating cigarette butts. They're tasting anything that drips down the river, including many, 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 many times your fly, and you have no idea that it's happening.
So it's really, when we say they're not on the bite, it could be we're just not on the take.
Yeah, maybe they're not on the bite, but maybe it's you just aren't on the hook. You're just not with it.
Yeah, yeah, not tuned in, not feeling it. Well, speaking to that, we're going to talk about some strategy and presentation things a little later, but, you know, based upon what you just said, and there, what can we do to better know that our fly is being taken in those kind of situations?
I think the most important thing you can do is fish with a tight line, get rid of the indicator, feel your fly along the riverbed, put your split shot, oh, maybe 2 inches, 3 inches from your fly. The trout are absolutely unafraid of your split shot. It looks like all the other stuff drifting down the riverbed, and they'll bite your split shot all the time. So keep it really close to the fly. Keep the weight out of the fly, and keep that connection between you and the fly so that when that fly moves just a hair, you'll be able to detect it. And the third thing that I do or try to impress upon people to do is to strike all the way through your drift. If you're fishing a nymph, you should strike three or four times along every single drift, because it's impossible to know when those fish are hanging on your fly. A lot of times they will come up and they will totally put the fly in their mouth, but they will drift down current at the exact same speed as your fly, and you'll never know it unless you start doing blind strikes. And I just get this little spastic twitch, 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 twitch during my drift, and that slows down the fly. It raises the fly, gives you a little tiny rising ring lift, and it also sets the hook.
Interesting. Now, when you're talking and fishing without an indicator, then are you, so you're having, let's say you're fishing a two-fly rig, or maybe you don't, but you put that weight just above the fly, then the weight is basically hanging near the bottom, if not dragging the bottom, and the flies are floating up in the column.
Right.
Right? And so you're using more of the weight position the flies off the bottom than an indicator of holding them up off the bottom.
Exactly. Instead of having a bobber, you're having a sinker.
Yeah. Okay. Lane in Antioch, California, writes and he says, "Thank you and Lisa for producing such a great video on bugs of the underworld. I've watched it multiple times, and I'm really impressed with this high-quality video. Would you be willing to speak to what conditions cause trout to eat selectively versus opportunistically?" I think we already answered that. But thanks again for all the knowledge you've contributed to the sport. And, you know, you did, I think, already answer that. But, you know, it brings up that video, which you were kind enough to send me a copy of. And that is the first time that I had really seen what was going on under the water. I mean, you look at a lot of diagrams and books and so forth, but to actually see the bugs swimming and working was a big enlightenment to me. Is that, I assume that was the purpose of
the that was the DVD? Purpose. Because you can talk yourself blue in the face and even take stills. And, you know, if a picture's worth a thousand words, a video clip must be worth, you know, a whole dialogue, because you don't even have to speak when people are watching, you know, a mayfly nymph swim to the surface, emerge through the film, bust open its wings and fly away. It suddenly all comes together and you go, wow, my fly doesn't look anything like that. But you go to the bins of the fly shop and, you know, people imitate other people's flies, or they imitate what they see from the surface. But when you see the transparency, the translucency, the sparkle, the different shifts of color when these guys emerge, instantly you become a better fly tyer and a better fly fisher. And even if you don't tie flies or fish with flies, you just have a different grasp of what's going on. And you can't describe that. People think they know what they're looking at, but they don't.
We got a kind of a follow-up question here on the Internet, Ralph, and it's Bart in Oxford, Michigan, asks, "From your nymphing conversation, it sounds like you might be promoting Czech nymphing or European nymphing methods."
Actually, I don't. I'm glad I was given the opportunity to clarify that, because Czech nymphing is a type of nymphing where you're pulling the fly downstream. Your rod tip is downstream of the fly, and you will have a tight line to the fly, and you're pulling it into the fish's mouth. So if they're sampling the fly, very good chance you're going to pull the fly into its mouth, and that's why it works so well. But when you actually go underwater, even with the high stick drift, your fly is drifting faster than the naturals. And when you're pulling the fly, it stands out from the crowd. It is bouncing downstream, and many, many fish avoid it. I mean, they'll swim out of the way because this fly is coming way too fast. Czech nymphing is a numbers game, and you're going to hook most of the fish that sample your fly, but you're going to get far fewer samplers. If you hold your rod tip upstream, and that's what I do, I hold my rod tip upstream of the fly, so the line is going at about a 45-degree angle through the water to the fly, and it's taut. When I raise my rod tip upstream, I'm slowing down the drift, which makes it look much more like a natural. I'm raising it up the bottom, which is a very, very strong strike trigger. And, of course, I'm setting the hook. I'm actually fishing exactly the opposite of Czech nymphing and really trying to get into the natural drift. And trout, you know, just because the fly is underwater doesn't mean you can just suddenly ignore drag-free drift. They want it to look like the real guys.
Mm-hmm. Good. Another follow-up question. Brian in Dayton, Ohio writes in, "The general rule of thought is that under, at least his thought, is that under ideal conditions, rainbows will constantly feed while browns will feed in spurts. Do you agree with this?"
Boy, you know, I've never been to Dayton, and maybe they're different there. But that's a pretty general statement. I think, again, it probably depends where you are. If a brown trout happens to eat a big crayfish, it probably isn't going to need to eat anything for another couple of days. Versus if they're eating trichos, that same brown is going to be feeding all day long. So I think it really depends on the food, you know, the area, and just the, everything that's going to influence that location versus species.
We've got a couple of questions here, kind of overlap. Jim in Jefferson City, Missouri writes, what differences have you observed in the feeding habits of stock versus wild trout? And then Gary in Williamstown, Massachusetts asks, when trout, year-old browns and brookies and two-year-old rainbows are released in a freestone stream, how long does it take for them to figure out what's edible in their new natural environment? So maybe you can kind of address both those, versus, you know, the stocked versus wild trout and how they feed.
Yeah, you know, stocked trout come from a whole range of, you know, lifestyles. Some are raised in just concrete ponds and all they do is fed pellets, you know, that comes on a timer once a day or twice a day. And others, like the Alpers Ranch out here, they're raised in open ponds and prairie where they get lots of blow-in food. And in terms of feeding, their feeding habits are probably pretty close to wild trout. But when you put these fish into, you know, an environment such as a lake, you know, take them out of the hatchery environment, put them in a lake or in a river, almost immediately they start sampling whatever's in the water. And again, it doesn't have to be food. It can be sticks. It can be sand. It can be any kinds of detritus drifting downstream. And I don't think it takes stocked fish very long to figure out what's edible and what's not edible. I think where their problem is they don't figure out how to get it. You'll see stocked fish hanging out in really strange places, places that are not feeding lives. And they haven't figured out that they need to go find that food or they need to go set up in a place that will give them a lot of food. But if the food comes into their, you know, their terrain, they'll eat it. But I think their big problem is adjusting to the environment rather than adjusting to the food. And in terms of how long does it take to figure out brookies and browns, you know, I don't know that there's a difference. There probably is. You know, they're pretty different fish, char versus a trout, but I honestly couldn't give you an honest answer on that.
Okay, well, it's time to take a short break here, Ralph, and we'll be back in a minute and talk more about fish food. Cortland Line Company recognizes the rapidly expanding market for the precise nymphing methods pioneered by the European competitive angling community. Czech, French, and Spanish nymphing styles increase productivity by keeping anglers in close contact with their flies. Extra long, light action rods and unique rigging are the rule for this type of fishing, but standard taper floating lines are often a hindrance. Cortland Line has been developing, testing, and perfecting the ultimate taper configuration to empower nymph fishermen using this new methods, and our new competition nymph line is finally ready for release. Look for the competition nymph line to be available this summer from Cortland. Your nymph rod has met its match. For more information on Cortland Lines, visit www.cortlandline.com. That's www.cortlandline.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Ralph Cutter about fish food. If you'd like to ask Ralph a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. And use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Ralph, at this point in the show, I always ask my guests, you know, what's going on in their fly fishing world. So you've done quite a few adventures in your life. You got anything going on right now or in the plans?
Oh, well, we just, you know, kind of winding down a real busy summer, did a lot of fishing in a lot of different places. Our daughter got married in Montana, so we took that as an excuse to spend a month out there and fishing around. And kind of a different year because it was late. We, you know, fishing is probably 6 weeks behind the normal year because we got so much snow and so much runoff, but we're making up for it now. We really aren't in the fall doldrums yet, and we're having late summer fishing, and I think we're going to get some frost pretty quick, which will bump us right into the good, you know, late fall fishing. Our current projects right now, Lisa and I are filming a video about what trout do underwater. I mean, our first video is about insects and what they look like and, you know, what they do, how they behave underwater. And this video we're working on is more trout-centric. We're working on what trout see, how they perceive things, you know, where they like to be in the river, how they react to your fly, how they react to normal flies, that kind of thing. And it's very, very rewarding when you get a good day on the water, but, you know, 9 days out of 10, it's pretty frustrating because trout don't do anything on command. And, you know, just when they start doing what you want them to do, a cloud comes over the sun, or you'll get a cow walking across the river upstream and you get a bunch of, you know, dust coming down the river. So it's going to be a long time in the making, but that said, it's the kind of thing that I would rather do than anything else. I love being underwater and watching fish. So it's a great excuse to be doing that.
Yeah. Now, for people to keep track and find out what you're up to and the books, and I know you run a school as well, what's your website address so that people can find you?
The website is flyline.com.
Flyline.com.
Yeah. Flyline.com.
Great, great. And I take it you have your books there? And
Yeah, we've got our books and the video and some flies. We really try not to compete with the fly shops. I mean, you're never going to come to our site and find a sale or something. We want them to sell the stuff mostly because, you know, they sell most of our stuff, and I don't want to undercut them and be their competition. So if you have a local fly shop, go in there and buy the book, go in there and buy the video. But if you can't get it or you just can't wait to get them, you know, go to flyline.com, and I would love to sell them to you.
Okay, great, great. And what kind of school do you – tell me a bit about your school.
Our school started in 1981, and it originally started as a guide service. It was called the North Sierra Guide Service. And it was, you know, guiding in the Tahoe, Truckee, Carson River area. And very, very quickly, we realized that these guys are getting ripped off. I mean, they're paying a bunch of money to go fishing for a day. And, you know, they learn how to fish that day, but not the next day or the next week or the next month or the next river. They are learning how to fish where you are at that time. So we developed a class that would make good anglers and kind of incorporated that into the guide trips. And finally, there was more demand for classes than guide trips, so we just stopped doing that kind of guiding. And it's been 30 years now, going into our 31st year of teaching people, and we've taught thousands and thousands of people from all over the world. It's pretty rewarding. Our classes, we have one-day introduction classes. We have one-day private classes where, you know, you and your mother-in-law can show up at the river and we'll teach you how to fish. Or we have two-day classes that are much more in-depth. Again, a two-day intro class and a two-day intermediate advanced class. And we also have entomology classes and streamer classes and that kind of stuff.
Great, great. Sounds very comprehensive there. Yeah. Well, good. Well, let's get back, talk about fish food. Tony in Australia writes in, they got a lot of nice trout down there in Tasmania. He says, big trout will sometimes move a surprisingly long way to take a very small food item, one apparently not worth the energy expended by the fish. Do you have any theories as to why or, more usefully, when this might occur?
Well, I know when it occurs, but I don't know why. We see it a lot when you have very fast swimming prey, like a midge pupa or a caddis pupa going to the surface. There's something about that, you know, they're encased in a bubble of air. They're very shiny. They're very easy to see. And very often we'll see a pretty large fish expend way more energy than it's ever going to get from chasing that bug down. And I think it must be the combination of the speed, the fly is rising, and that it's bright. Those three things in themselves are all triggers, and when you combine them all into one little bug, I think the trout just can't help itself. I don't know how that evolved. I mean, obviously it doesn't make any sense in the evolution of this fish, but I think those are just the three cues that fish sees, and it just has to eat the thing.
Okay, here's an interesting one. Joanne in California says, an old trout fisherman told me that trout eat grass. Have you ever observed this? What do you think?
Absolutely, they do. I don't know if they eat grass, but they eat moss. And actually, if you go to Fall River up in Northern California, you can stand on Island Bridge or Silver Creek up in Idaho. You can get up there and watch those fish, and as clumps of moss drift downstream, those trout will rise up and eat it and swallow it. They don't rise up and sample it and spit it out. It's gone. And it's probably because you pick up those little pieces of drifting moss, and they're loaded with betus nymphs and scuds and sow bugs, all kinds of stuff. So they're ingesting the moss, but really they're getting the food value out of the bugs.
A little bit of salad never hurt anybody.
A little bit of roughage in there, yeah.
That's interesting. I never knew that. But it definitely makes sense. Definitely makes sense. We've got a question from Tom in Coleyville, Texas. And he says, what is the quickest and easiest way to evaluate a river in summer and winter months to make the best choice on what color, size, line weight, and fly to use?
Ooh.
A lot of variables there.
Throw Rapalas. Cover all the water. You know, I think that's probably the biggest thing is to cover the water. Make, you know, don't spend a lot of time in one spot. You know, move around. That's why drift boats are so effective. You can cover lots of water, and that'll give you a good idea what the fish want. You know, fish with a big dry and a dropper, and if they don't want that, go to a little dry and a dropper. If they don't want that, go for a dark fly and a light fly. You know, I love tandem rigs for searching water to figuring out what's going on. But probably as important as switching your flies frequently, I think moving and hitting the sweet spots, because if you're fishing dead water, the trout aren't going to be telling you anything. So my game plan would be to move quickly.
When you say quickly, you know, you're fishing around, and how many casts do you make in there? How much time do you give it?
Oh, boy. Again, it depends. But it depends how many high-value spots you've got there, these targets. If you've got a lot of little bathtubs in a riffle, you're probably going to want to throw your fly over each one. If you've got good undercut banks, you're probably going to want to make sure you hit the undercut banks and hit the back eddies. But I wouldn't make three or four drifts to the exact same back eddy or across the same undercut or into the same bucket in the stream. I do one or two and then go to the next one, go to the next one.
Well, and yeah, keep moving.
Then maybe change your fly, go back up to the top and hit those again if they look like really sweet spots or you've caught a lot of fish there in the past.
Well, I know from what you said earlier where you said, you know, fish are kind of tasting almost everything, and unless there's a super heavy hatch on where they're being highly selective, I've got to assume that they're just about taking everything. So I know when I've fished tandem rigs, and trying to figure it out, sometimes they hit the top, sometimes they hit the bottom one, and then I really don't know what they're doing. You know?
Right, right.
Like they're taking whatever.
A lot of times they're taking whatever, but a lot of times they can be really discriminating. And a lot of times it can be the water's turbid or it's cold, and they're simply not going to move very far. So you kind of have to hit them on the head and figure that one out, too. Not only what they want to eat, but you know, how you have to present that fly. Do they want it really slow in the soft water, or do they want it swinging on tight line or even stripped?
Yeah. Kurt in Utah asks, do trout favor certain nymphs over others? Will they move further for a bigger or different nymph? Do trout eat certain food items differently? Do they inhale some food items and taste and test others? How often does a trout eat and reject a non-food item? How often does a nympha miss a strike because the fish rejects it faster than an angler can react? Lots of questions. All along the same line.
That's not a question. Look, do trout favor certain nymphs over others? I don't think so. And I know there are other people that think differently. Leonard Wright wrote a wonderful book, The Way of a Trout, and he swears up and down that trout don't eat little yellow stonefly nymphs. Well, I've watched them eat millions of little yellow stonefly nymphs. So maybe, you know, there's a difference, you know, where people live, what these fish want, what they don't want. But I've never seen a trout say, I want a, you know, a Taranarsi stonefly over a golden stonefly or a betis over a delphidus. They just eat what is ever there. The idea that they might move farther for a bigger nymph, I think that depends. You know, early in the season, perhaps in the middle of the season, they're going to move away from that bigger nymph. A lot of times you can scare them with a big piece of food. You might want to go small, even though there are big nymphs in there.
Why is that?
I don't know. I really don't know. I just watch it enough to know that I feel the need to scale back sometimes when the trout are spooky or they're being selective. They'll very often take 18 of that little copper john when they won't take a 12. Mm-hmm. It's just too big, too flashy. Maybe they've seen just too many of them. I honestly don't know why.
Okay.
His other part of this question was, do they inhale some trout foods and taste test to others? Yes, absolutely yes, and that's a huge question. Little bits of food, they will intend to take deeply. So if you have a little nymph, they'll intend to just inhale it. And I think that's one of the reasons you might catch more fish on smaller flies is because that fly is in their mouth longer. A bigger fly, very often the trout will actually take it between the tip of its mandible, you know, the tip of its jaw, tip of its mandible, and just lightly bite on it or nibble on it even, and then puff, you know, spit it back out. So they do. They really make a difference. If you have soft flies, you know, with a lot of fur or rubber in them, they tend to hang on to them longer or even chew on them. They're still sampling them. They're not swallowing them. When they want to swallow something, they do it quickly. But when they're sampling them, they'll chew, they'll gnaw, they'll spit it out and then bite it again. And that's really a bonus for soft-bodied flies. I don't like hard plastic ribbing or much copper wire because that fly goes in there and it goes out pretty quick.
Interesting.
I think I'm just jotting these questions down. Did I get all his questions?
Yeah, and the last one was, how often does a nympher miss a strike because the fish rejects it faster than an angler can react?
Embarrassingly often. I mean, it's so often people flat out don't believe me when I tell them. We just got back from filming golden trout. We spent about a week up in the high country, had mules packing all our video gear and weight belt and dry suit and all that kind of stuff. And I sat underwater and filmed these fish while Lisa fished over them. And Lisa's a really good fisherman, but she could get a drift where maybe three different fish would eat her fly, a nymph, and she had no idea.
Really?
She had no idea.
That is embarrassing, isn't it?
It is. And, I mean, even better than that, I went up with a buddy of mine, Jan Kurahara, who's a world-class fisherman. We were in a lake, and he was fishing a sinking line, stripping a streamer towards him. I mean, you would think that when you have a taut line and you're stripping it, that you would hook these fish. Well, it was in a pre-spawning stage, big school of trout, big school of goldens right before a creek. And he was stripping his streamer right through that thing, and he would have fish that would be attached to his streamer for 5 seconds at a time. He'd have fish that would grab his streamer and swim 3 feet to the right or the left or up and down and then spit it out. And he never knew it. And I kept saying, Jan, why aren't you setting? And he's saying, well, I'm not getting any hits. I said, oh, man. Watch my hand. I'm going to hold my hand above the water, and when a trout bites your fly, I'm going to drop my hand and you strike. We started doing that, and he was dumbfounded. And he's fished all over the world. He's a great fisherman, but had no idea that these fish were on his fly for so long.
Mm. Yeah, with somebody like Lisa, who's, you know, fishes so much and is so good, you think about the new anglers out there even some of us old anglers aren't as good as she is. How many fish we're missing?
We're missing a lot. I miss a lot. You know, it's but that's part of the game. You know, you just kind of learn that. And indicators really give you a false sense of understanding what's going on down there, because it takes a lot to make an indicator move. It really does. Those fish really have to – they basically hook themselves by the time the indicator starts doing anything.
Right, and that's going to happen, just a numbers game there. You know, you're going to catch a fish now and again. But I've noticed that, you know, fishing with certain people, you know, fishing side by side where, you know, one person is catching way more fish than the other. And I think it has to do with those multiple sets that you're doing and just, you know, sensing it in some way, shape, or form. And the guy that's not catching them is just not doing the same thing, even everything else, you know, being equal. Interesting question here. Thomas Redmond, Washington says, what precautions should be taken with subsurface flies with respect to trout's ability to smell?
Wow, that is a good question. And yeah, it's kind of along the lines of that question. Well, I've tied everything right on this fly. It looks perfect. But how can the fish ignore that giant hook hanging out of the bottom of it? You know, I don't really know. I think the smell thing is the same game. I don't think trout use their sense of smell to locate prey very often. I mean, they have a fantastic sense of smell. I mean, a steelhead is just a big trout, and they can swim 2,000 miles across the ocean and return to their natal, you know, little creek by sense of smell. But I've fished with flies that came out of the fly box still smelling like head cement or insect repellent or whatever, sunscreen. And I honestly can't say that I see much of a difference. And I know they can smell because I've taken like crayfish and I put them in like three sets as a sock, and I smash that crayfish up inside the sock in the river. Then I'll go underwater and just hold the socks. There's no bit of crayfish going out, but only its smell. And it's just a matter of minutes, if not less, where you have three or four trout, you know, in that smell plume, that trail of smell being washed out. So smell has something, you know, they do work with their sense of smell, but I don't think very much.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Time to take a break. But we've got plenty more questions and great questions that people have sent in here. So we'll return in just a moment with Ralph Cutter and talking more about fish food. Royal Gorge Anglers is a full-service fly shop on the Arkansas River in Canyon City, Colorado. They provide both walk, wade, and float fishing guide service on the Arkansas, South Platte, and several private high country ranches. They specialize in fly fishing education and work to assure that everyone taking a trip leaves being a better fly fisher. For the best service and the most fun in the Southern Rockies, visit the folks at Royal Gorge Anglers, the gateway to Southern Colorado. Located conveniently on U.S. 50, only 45 minutes from Colorado Springs. For more information, visit their website at www.royalgorgeanglers.com. That's www.royalgorgeanglers.com. Or call them at 888-994-6743. That's 888-994-6743. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Ralph Cutter about fish food. If you'd like to ask Ralph a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Ralph, we did have question come in on the Internet, and it kind of ties in with one that was sent in earlier by Larry in New Mexico. But Ken Atkins in Granite City, Illinois, writes in on the Internet here, how do we know what stage of an insect's life that the fish are keying in on at any given time if a seine is not giving us any clues? Is it the way that the fish are rising?
Yeah, good question. You know, if fish aren't rising, they're obviously eating something underwater. And so you need to look, look as best you can through the water and see if you can see fish twisting and turning. It's best to get up high. It's best to have the sun behind you. It's best to be looking downstream because when they open their mouth, they've got this white little flash that shows you where they are. And if they're right on the bottom and not moving much, but they're just wiggling their head back and forth and eating, they're taking something in the drift, probably caddis larva, maybe caddis pupa on the drift along the bottom. If they're swimming erratically but they're still underwater, they're probably taking pupas of either caddis or midges. Those are bright, fast-swimming guys, and the fish will dart back and forth and change direction quickly to take them. If they're taking the emergers of the caddis or of the midges, they move very, very quickly, and they'll blow up under the water. You'll see very, very splashy rises. That means, you know, those caddis are coming off the water quick, and these fish are trying to chase them down quickly. Mayflies typically don't get the same kind of explosive rise because they're much slower as they emerge. So a trout will tend to set up, and you'll get these bulging rises or these very deliberate sucking or kissing or sipping types of rises. And then, of course, if you have wings and the trout are taking the wings, that's easy to figure out. Sometimes you need to watch. You know, this is a rule that works about 80% of the time. If a trout rises and leaves a bubble behind, in the ring of its rise, it took something off the surface. That same trout can show his eyeball, his nose, his head, his dorsal fin, and not leave a bubble in the ring of the rise. They're taking something in the film. They're not sucking in air as they suck in that pre-emerger. So if you see fish rising and you're casting drives and you're not catching them, stop a second and look for those bubbles. And again, if there's bubbles in the rings of the rise, they are invariably taking drives. And if there are no bubbles in the rings of the rise, they're usually taking something just under the film. So there you go.
So it sounds like from what you're saying, if you can't seine them, and like in lakes many times you can't, and you're not seeing any surface activity, probably a good thing to know is what bugs are in that piece of water, whether it be a lake or stream.
Sure.
What bugs should be there that time of year, which if you don't know the water, you should be talking to a local guide or shop to find out what's going on, and then at least you could give it your best guess.
Right.
As to what the emergers might be, right?
I would agree totally with that.
Yeah, I know. And like you say, that depends where you are in the country as to what's going on and what time of year and all those things. But
oh, yeah, and again, it can be, you know, you can have one lake. I'm thinking of a lake on the east side of the Sierra that is very, very sterile. I mean, it really has only midges in it. Very, very few of any other kind of bugs. But, you know, probably 2 miles away, there's another lake that has a weedy bottom that's loaded with calabatus. And you're going to have to approach both of those lakes differently. And, you know, if you're new to the scene, you should go to the local fly shop and say, hey, what's up?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay, let's talk a bit about we got a question in here about terrestrials. Ed in Leesburg, Florida writes in, Ralph, of all the terrestrials which drop into a stream, which, if any, are most appealing to trout?
Boy, again, it depends. There you go. That it depends. I think that trout really enjoy, and I hate being so anthropomorphic, but they seem to really enjoy wasps, bees, and ants, and they're all similarly related. They all are loaded with formic acid. And for some reason, trout seem to go out of their way to eat those things. And like yellow jackets, I've watched them eat a number of yellow jackets on the water and get stung. And they obviously got stung. They're rolling their eyes and they're shaking their head back and forth and clamping their jaws open and shut and flaring their gills. And then 3 seconds later, they rise and eat another yellow jacket. So there's something there that they really like. And I hate to use the word like when you're talking about a trout, but there's something there that's very attractive. Versus grasshoppers or beetles, you know, they eat them all the time. But, the question is, what do they prefer or most appealing? Just from my own observation, I think they like bees. I think they like wasps. And I think they like ants if they're given a choice.
Interesting. I would have never thought that.
it's counterintuitive. And again, of all the terrestrials, terrestrials mean, bugs that live on shore. They don't stand on the water like a regular aquatic insect very long, and they sink quickly. So even though perhaps it's not as much fun, fish your terrestrials with a split shot, and you'll do a lot better.
It might be interesting to fish a hopper dropper and have the dropper being a sinking hopper and see what the...
That's a very good test. I urge all listeners to do that.
Yeah.
I think you might be surprised.
Might be trying that this weekend. Okay. We've got, let's see. Getting a little static on our line here. Hopefully it'll go away. There.
I just switched phones. One has a fresh battery now.
Oh, okay.
Maybe that was it.
Lane in Antioch, California says, when do trout become predatory and feed primarily on bait fish? Is there a specific size where they turn to bait fish, or are certain trout just more inclined to this food source than others?
There's some trout that are famous for being, piscivorous, and that means eating other fish. But all trout will eat a fish that's smaller than him. And we used to have all kinds of trout we would have in aquariums. And when these little trout, whether they were brookies or rainbows or browns or goldens, when they were about 4 inches long, we'd feed them 1-inch guppies. And they would devour them. They would, even at 3 inches, they would eat 1-inch guppies. And that's a food that's 1/3 their size. So I don't know that trout ever really convert to eating other fishes. I think they always have that, embedded instinct to eat other fishes. But about 12 or 13 or 14 inches, I know on the truckee, the browns particularly convert to not really so much eating other fishes, but eating crayfish. So there is a size in their life when they find other food forms, more available or perhaps more appealing. But I think that the takeaway from this is that, if a 3-inch fish is going to eat a 1-inch fish, your 3-inch streamer that you think is only targeting giant fish will easily be sucked in by a 9-inch fish.
Mm-hmm.
Don't be afraid to fish streamers. These guys can put giant things in their mouth, and they're very willing to do it.
Yeah, that's interesting. Ken in Hardwick, New Jersey says, how prevalent are darters in a trout's diet? I know some patterns were developed for smallmouth. I would think they could be equally effective for trout.
Got me there. We don't have darters in this end or, around where we live.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I have no idea.
I suppose based upon what you just said, it's another fish. So.
It's another fish. I'm sure they would eat them. And, a darter has a lot of the same characteristics as a sculpin. They sit close to the bottom. They swim in little spurts when they can. They aren't very good at just racing and away from a trout and beating it downstream. So I would imagine that I know that our sculpins are hugely important. I imagine back east or southeast that darters would probably be equally as important. But I can't say that.
Right. What about George from Alabama asks, what about crayfish? Do the trout seek them out?
They love crayfish. They love crayfish. And when I go diving, in our local rivers, and I look at the big browns, I mean the big 28, 30, 32-inch browns, they have long-term scars all around their face from crayfish. I mean, they've all been dining on crayfish, and most of them have fresh scars, too. And, you know, see flesh that's white or pink. They love crayfish. And here it's at about 12 to 14 inches that, particularly our browns, they convert to crayfish.
Steve in Petaluma, California, he says, how do trout relate to crayfish in a stream, and what are the key triggering elements of a good crayfish imitation? And I might extend his question to say, and how do you fish a crayfish imitation in a stream as opposed to a lake?
I think, at least for here, our crayfish have orange on the bottom of their claws, and they're typically green or gray or bluish on the top of their claws. But when they swim by swimming backwards. They pulse with their tail, and with each flip of their tail, their claws raise in the air, and then they drop. They raise in the air, and they drop. And so you've seen this bright flash of orange, and then kind of that orange disappears. It's hidden by green, and then you get this flash of orange. It's these pulses of a bright contrast that comes out. That said, I have never seen or been able to fish myself an effective, you know, fleeing crayfish. It just looks stupid. It just doesn't look like a real animal out there. The best way I've found to fish crayfish is a drag-free drift. And what I do is I'll lob a crayfish imitation into the shallow riffles, give it some slack, raise the rod, and then as the riffles descend or drop into a pocket or a pool, I'll high-stick it down. I'm not going to hold it back from falling, but I want a pretty taut line as it drops. And most of those grabs are right there on the drop. And you know, all crayfish periodically go through a molt, and when they molt their exoskeleton, there's a period of time from 20 minutes to an hour where they can't swim. You know, they have no structural integrity. They're soft, their shell is very soft, and I think a lot of those guys get liberated from wherever they're hiding by the current, and they tumble downstream, and they fall into these pools where they're easy prey, and I think that's the best way to imitate these guys.
And that stream, what about lakes?
Oh boy!
Hard to imitate?
You know, yeah, lakes are kind of a different ball game. I haven't fished crayfish very often in lakes, but when you watch crayfish swimming across the bottom of the lakes, they're typically very close to the bottom, and each time they pulse their tail, they'll release a big puff of silt off the bottom. And you know, the theory is that if you do that with something like a leadhead jig or something, a clouse or minnow, and you let it hit the bottom between each strip, that you're going to be triggering the trout to eat it. Again, that's theory. It may be one of those myths, legends, and lies. I don't know if that's true or not, but it sure sounds good.
After writing Fish Food, did you make changes to the way you approach your fly tying?
Yeah. I have a good deal with Umqua where I can buy my flies wholesale, and whenever I can get away with buying wholesale flies, it sure beats tying them. I love inventing flies. I love trying to figure out flies. But I really, really, really get bored quickly sitting down and tying six dozen at the same fly. So, you know, after writing Fish Food, the changes I made in my fly tying was to be sloppier and sloppier and faster and try to get away with doing the least amount of, you know, steps in tying a fly as I can. I love the bird's nest. There's basically three steps and you got your fly.
Walt asks, what fly tying materials have you found to be the biggest trigger attractors in fresh stillwater fishing in different types of water polarity?
Ooh, best of trigger attractors. I think anything that moves, you know, marabou, bunny, bucktail. I love bucktail. People look at bucktail and they kind of lost contact with that stuff. When you put that bucktail in the water, It's as sinuous and wafty as the best craft fur or marabou. Bucktail is really nice. It moves up and down. It's got a long taper, so it really takes a lot of energy from the front of that taper and speeds it up as that energy goes down to the tip of the taper, just like a fly line or a fly rod does. And you get lots and lots of motion with bucktail. The other material I like a lot is wood duck flank rather than mallard or gadwall or pintail or whatever, because the wood duck is very, very stiff, and when it gets in the water, it vibrates. It's just the opposite of mallard, which wafts in the water. Wood duck vibrates, and you get the least amount of motion or least amount of action, and that whole fly just wiggles like it's alive.
Hmm. Interesting. Larry, and this is another rather long entry here, he says, clearly fly tying cannot duplicate exactly what a natural food item looks like in the stream, yet trout are caught on flies all the time. I think that if it resembles the food item to maybe 60% or 70% of the original, then a fish would probably grab it. But what are the key ingredients that a fly tire must achieve? For example, what's most important on a nymph? Eyes, legs, segmentation? And then he asked about streamer or dry fly in the same respect.
What's the most important by far is presentation. I mean, we can go into size, shape, color, silhouette, all these different parameters, and pick them apart. And I think color is the least important. I think it should be, you know, if the fly tends to be dark, you know, maybe your imitation should be dark. If it's light, it should be light. But much more important than eyes and legs and segmentation and all the stuff, the crazy things that fly fishers do, I think your biggest thing is having it behave like the natural and being of a reasonable size. Now, if you've got nymphs in your lake that are size 10 to size 18, you put on a 14, it's probably going to work. But it's probably not going to work if you move it along as fast as a fish can swim. You probably going to want to make it rise and fall and swim close to the shorelines. Most nymphs don't just strike out from shore and swim to deep water. You know, they're swimming to shore. They're swimming along the top of the weed beds. They're swimming parallel to the shore. But when I see people in float tubes, you know, 30 feet away casting to the shore and stripping their nymph towards them, I just have to yell at them, you know, because they're doing exactly the opposite of what the natural nymphs are doing.
Okay. What about in that particular example? I guess it all depends, too, on if you're talking about, like, damselfly nymphs.
Yeah, you know, damselflies, you know, there's a good one, because people cast that damselfly out and strip it back to them. Whereas, unless you're in a full-blown migration, damselfly nymphs don't swim around very much. They hang out. They'll drift. And one of the cool things about damsels is that they try to get away from a trout. When they see a trout and they've got very good eyes, they will dive for the bottom. And so what most people are doing are stripping their fly, keeping it in the same, you know, same contour of the lake as the trout's chasing it. Pretty soon the trout looks at this and goes, man, this doesn't behave like any other damsel I've seen. So what you can do is you can put a small split shot in front of the damsel nymph, swim it slowly, swim it fast enough that the split shot doesn't drop the fly, but periodically pause and allow the split shot to fall and allow the damsel fly to swim to the bottom, because that's what a damsel fly does when it's afraid. Again, we're more into presentation
yeah.
than...
Yeah.
And for dries, you know, damselfly dries are huge. You know, damselfly dries, many of them, if not most of them, go underwater to lay their eggs. And here's a big old insect with big old wings, and they trap air between their wings, and they actually breathe off of this trapped air. And they might go 4 or 5 feet underwater on the reeds and the tules and the cattails to insert their eggs there. And once they've done ovipositing in the cattails, stems or whatever, they let go, and the buoyancy of these wings rides them back to the surface. And when you can't catch any fish during a damselfly hatch, it's probably because most of those fish, are, instead of chasing damselfly nymphs, are grazing on these great big, easy-to-see, easy-to-catch food items. And you would fish those with a split shot and then put dry desiccant shake on them so they want to float. And the split shot sits on the bottom, and your damselfly dry is suspended. It's rising mid-water column. And you can make that move up and down simply by giving a few small strips. It sinks, give it slack, it'll rise until it hangs up against that split shot. Deadly.
Need to take a quick break here again. But when we come back, we'll talk with Ralph more about fish food and presentation and strategies. And so we'll be right back. Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut, and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please tour their website at www.dryflies.com. That's www.dryflies.com to view the fishing products and guide services they offer in Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. It's www.dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Ralph Cutter about fish food. If you would like to ask Ralph a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Ralph, DB in Escondido writes in, because the same flies are listed most of the time, such as royal wolf, pheasant tail, hare's ear, woolly booger, all the standards that have been around for years, is it more productive to use other patterns because the fish see these same patterns so often?
That's actually a really good question, and the answer is yes and no. If you were to go, fish over really selective trout with, a royal wolf that's been fished over with royal wolves for a long time, they're going to figure that out. But very often, if you go to a place where fish haven't seen a royal wolf, even though they're listed a lot of these classic patterns just aren't sold very often. Now, I don't know the last time I don't know how many dozens of royal wolves get sold or hare's ears. I mean, they're sold out there, but it's not like it used to be. Now there's all these specialized flies that people use. Some of them are very, very effective. Some of them don't work very well at all. And I think sometimes going back to the old classic patterns can fool fish that have been seeing all this new stuff. So I would not discard those old patterns. A trude is a classic, and Gary LaFontaine discovered that. When he was fishing all these heavily fished waters in Montana where people were imitating the left wing is bent at a 45-degree angle and these minute differences in the flies that when he would go back with these trudes, he was outfishing everybody. And I think there's a time and a place to go play and see if these fish haven't forgotten that, all these old patterns still work.
Well, many times, we ask, and there's some questions coming up for you here, too, but, we get asked, well, what's your favorite fly or what's your go-to fly and so forth. But I'll tell you, one fly that always seems to rise to the top is a parachute Adams. And, you think, well, how common is that? It's so common, but the reason it is so common is so successful.
It sure is. And I think that the parachute Adams is probably one of the best-selling flies that was ever made. And it's not a new fly. It's been around for a long time. And it works, and it works, and it works, and it works over very fickle fish, and it works over dumb fish. So there's something in certain flies that just work.
Yeah, yeah. And no matter how old or classic they are, they're still, they work.
And I hate seeing a lot of these, like the Royal Coachman. It doesn't imitate anything. But a Royal Coachman, you'd be lapped off the river if you open up your fly box and you had a Royal Coachman. But I get lapped off the river all the time, and they work. Fish like them. I don't know why, but,
Yeah, and it depends. in the lake down here by my house, basically if it floats, they like it. So, if it looks buggy and floats, because there's all these meadows there and all these bugs fall into the water there, so... I haven't tried that, but it probably worked well down there. Norm in Nevada City, California, writes in, Ralph, Fish Food, your book, describes your imitating bud midges with orange antron. Please describe how you tie the fuzzy antron material to appear like a blood midge.
This isn't Norm Sauer, right?
Yeah, Norm Sauer.
Hi, Norm.
Is this a joke?
No, Norm,
though.
Yeah, he's a good guy. You take the antron, you take like crayfish-colored antron. I think that's the name of the colors, crayfish. And it comes in it can be a touch dubbing or it can be, in a thicker wine. But either way, you just put it lightly on a wax thread, spin it really good so it's not really fuzzy, but it coats the thread. You don't want to have too much. You just want to make that thread turn orange. And then wrap it tightly. And then pull out the dubbing just a little bit so it's not a hard, slick surface. And there you go. It's easy.
Okay.
And then typically you overwrap it with a piece of copper wire.
If you had to, and here's the questions, Scott in Mill Valley, California. If you had to pick one fly each for spring, summer, fall, and winter in the Sierra, what would they be?
Bird's nest, bird's nest, bird's nest, and bird's nest. If I had to jump out of an airplane in the middle of the Sierra and feed a family of six, that's the bug I'd want. It imitates anything underwater. You can swim it. It looks like a bait fish. You can dead drift it, and it looks like something dead in the film. You can fish it under the film. It looks like an emerger. You can fish it close to the bottom with a split shot, and, of course, it looks like a nymph. That is my number one fly. And my number two fly is the EC caddis. And typically I use the EC caddis in the summer and the fall, and in the spring and the winter I would use a bird's nest.
And you said the bird's nest is easy to tie on top of it all.
Exactly. And that's one of its great attributes. It's easy to tie. You're not afraid to lose it. You know, I have no, you know, hesitation whatsoever to throw it into a underneath an alder or a willow and thinking, oh, I might lose that fly. I don't want to cast there. Hey, it's a disposable fly.
Mm-hmm. I like those.
Yeah.
I was just looking in your book, and there's in the index, bird's nest, there's 10 references. So you talk about it a lot in your book, that's for sure.
It's just one of those flies that you can make do anything. I think another classic is the hare's ear, the golden hare's ear. But I don't think it's as good as the bird's nest. It's never proven to be as good. But it's another one of those flies you can tie on and pretty much make it look like anything.
So then we answered Al's question in Minnesota. He says, what's the universal fly, one that generally works everywhere? That would be the bird's nest, I think.
Sure it would.
Okay. Jim in White Plains, New York, says, when fishing a blizzard hatch, for example, Mother's Day caddis, and your fly is competing with thousands of naturals, is it better to present a hapless terrestrial, something like a beetle or ant? Or do you compete?
Well, probably your best thing is to tie something that looks like it's hatching, and then figure out where the fish are. Figure out where the lie is. Too many people do the scattergun thing.
Mm-hmm.
They'll see rising fish everywhere, and they'll just keep throwing their fly out there, and you know, every now and then they might catch a fish, but I think you're much better off, you know, finding a fish that's feeding. And, you know, something like the Mother's Day hatch, typically the rises are pretty rhythmic. You can time them pretty well. Every 15 seconds that mouth is going to come up. And I would hold the fly in the current about 3 feet above that trout, figure out what his cadence is, and then let the fly drift down, so hopefully so it intercepts, so the trout will intercept it as it just comes overhead.
Mm-hmm.
You can unmatch the hatch. It does work at times where you throw on something, some goofball thing, and trout go out of their way to eat it. But I think 9 times out of 10, you pretty much need to give the fish what it wants to eat. We, Lisa and I were filming on the Green River about, this is a while ago, maybe 10 years ago, and I had to get a picture of a grasshopper being eaten and the deadline. This was in January, and obviously the editor of the magazine didn't understand fly fishing. They said, I need a grasshopper picture in the next 2 weeks. And so we went to the Green River in Utah with 2,000 crickets in a box, and Lisa sat upstream and tossed crickets for 2 days, 2,000 crickets, over these fish that were rising to midges. And out of 2 days, 2,000 crickets, not a single fish even looked at these. They would literally push them out of the way to eat midges. So unmatching the hatch can work at times, but when these fish are keyed into what they want to eat, you better give them what they want to eat.
Mm-hmm. Try to figure it out as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, here's a very specific scenario from Walton, California. It's October, and the hatches are finished for the year in the lake. It's 9 a.m. The water surface temperature is 60 degrees. I know that the lake has dragons, leeches, damsels, and chironomids, and I am in 20 feet of water at the drop-off. What fly and method would you use, and why? Do you get the picture?
I have an answer for that. I would use a water boatman. If you have a lake that's got all those things and it's got leeches, damsels, and chironomids, you know that it's got a bunch of water boatmen. And water boatmen are very, very active in the fall. They migrate. They move around a lot. They're bright. Fish can see them from a long distance. They love to eat them. And you can cover a lot of water with them because you can swim them fast. And what I do for a water boatman is I take that old bird's nest, I shake it in a dry fly desiccant, you know, like Shimazaki Shake or Rio Product X. And it makes that bird's nest just glisten. It just traps this giant bubble around it. It's shiny. It looks like the plastron or the real shiny part on the water boatman. I'll put a split shot maybe 2 feet in front of it, cast it out there, let it sink, and then retrieve it in big pulses. Make it so it sinks, then rises to the surface, sinks and rises to the surface. And if I had to name one fall lake technique that would work in a searching condition, that's probably my go-to technique.
Hmm.
And, you know, with the water boatman, everybody ties on the legs, the little rubber legs and stuff. You can't even see those underwater. Don't worry about it. Just tie something on that has a nice shiny abdomen. That's mm-hmm. what you see.
That's what triggers them, yeah. Dane asks, what is the best for the truckie in the fall? And also tell your wonderful wife I said hello. You must know Dane Molina.
Yeah, he went to school with our daughters. Hey, Dane, what's the best for the truckie in the fall? Oh, I would say a bird's nest.
No, we're not going to get away from that damn bird's nest, are we?
Well, you know, the other thing that works in the fall are streamers. I love fishing streamers, but people tend to get really bored with streamers because they're heavy. They don't cast easily. They get hung up on the bottom. So I don't suggest streamers often, but I think they're way, way, way so good, especially in the fall when the big browns are moving around and they get belligerent. Find a gravel bed where they might be getting ready to spawn, and you know those browns are staging in the undercuts and under the log jams, and I'd crowd them with a big streamer, a big bright streamer, and just put it right in their face. You know, and they're going to get territorial. They're going to jump out at it, even if they don't want to eat it. If you push them with it, they're either going to run away or they're going to eat it. So, Dane, I'd say use a bird's nest, but if you really want to catch those big browns, use a streamer.
Now, we have a question from, this is a question came in online, so I'm gonna grab this one here. It's been sitting there since early in the show, but I wanted to get it when we were talking about flies and so forth. Andrew in Charlottesville, Virginia, I take it. Do you think the red that we tie in so many of our attractor patterns really represents blood to a trout's eye, or do you think they are keying in on something else?
Great question. I have no answer. I don't know. Color typically is the least important variable, but I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that there are times when color seems to be the most important variable, and red is a color the trout like, which is funny because when you look at red underwater, very, very quickly that red turns brown. It doesn't look red. If you're under 5 feet of water, you know, it's starting to turn orange, and by the time you get to 9 or 10 feet of water, it's brown. You wouldn't know that it's red. And if you get about 20 feet of water, it's green.
Well, I know there are a lot of flies being tied nowadays with what they call hot spots, you know?
Which right.
These yellow or red hot spots that seem to be attracting for whatever reason. But they.
I just tied up a couple of dozen jigs, and they're pretty big jigs. They're 1/8 ounce or 3/16 ounce jigs. And I painted red on the back of the head and every single one of them because I like it. It looks cool. And I think it works. But I don't know if it looks like blood or anything else, or maybe it's just this bright, contrasty color going through the water. I don't know.
Here's another good question. Bob in Flushing, Michigan says, in your book, you recommend, and I assume he means fish food, but maybe it's a different book. He says, you recommend using a solid floating on nymphs to imitate air bubbles. Is this effective only during hatches or at other times too?
Great question, because I kind of evangelize this, you know, putting the desiccant on the fly, on the nymph thing. But my rule of thumb is if you see insects on the wing, that is the time to put the desiccant on. Because when you see insects flying around, that means that there are nymphs ascending to the surface, or you have adult insects going down through the water to lay their eggs in the bottom. And those are the two times that you're going to find these brightly lit animals. When they're going underwater, they're carrying that air bubble with them because, remember, they lost their gills when they hatched. They have lungs. And so they need to bring that air with them. So they're bright and shiny and really vulnerable. And then a lot of these bugs, a lot of the pupa, when they swim to the surface, they're filled with gas. They're bright and shiny. And that is the trigger the trout want. We just discussed water boatman, which, of course, doesn't fill either one of these modes, but that's a time and place. If you're imitating the boatman, you'll always put the shake on. But if you don't see insects on the wing, I would not put the shake on. I would not make them shiny because all the nymphs, the larvae, and the pupa underwater at that time are probably pretty bland.
So when you're talking about, and he's talking about solid float and the shape, are you talking about the crystals getting mixed in with the material on the fly?
Yes. You take something like Frog's Fanny or Shimazaki Shaker, Rio, I think it's called Agent X. They're all the same thing. They get this stuff out of, when they melt glass for silicon chip, electronic boards and things, the gas, the silica in a gaseous state goes up these chimneys, and then it condenses on the inside of these stacks, inside of the chimneys, and periodically they clean the chimneys out, and this product is called foom, and it's this very, 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 very tiny spicules of glass, this condensed glass, and that's what sticks to your fly, and that's very, very hydrophobic. It doesn't like water. It pushes the water away, and so you just put that white fume into your bug. You can even scratch it into your bug with your hand, your fingernail. I think Frog Fanny even comes with a little brush to rub it deep into that material, and it works like magic. And then you replace it. You lift your rod up so your nymph is on the surface, and if your nymph stops floating, that's time to add more shake.
Okay, good. We're getting close to running out of time here, and we still, of course, have tons more questions to go through here. We've got, trying to pick one here. We're really out of time. So why don't we close it off here, but I'll give you a chance to maybe, kind of give some parting words to folks as to, what's most important out there when they're talking about fish food, and, what are the high points that you suggest they pay attention to as they're fishing?
The number one thing I would say is leave your rod in the truck, go down to the river, and just observe. See what's going on. If you have a rod in your hand, it's just too easy to just, I've got to cast that hot spot. There's a rising fish. That's cool if you see a rising fish, but sit back and watch it and wonder what it's rising to and why, and look around what the birds are doing. Look in the bushes. Are the bugs in the bushes? Are the bugs in the water? I would urge you to even take the next step and actually put on a face mask and go underwater and watch, because you will learn more in an hour underwater than you will for a whole summer of fishing. It's just so different than you would be led to believe by your mind's eye. It's just so, so, so different. But once you get on the water, I would, hit the hot spots. Try to figure out what these guys are eating and really change it up. Don't be afraid to take this, delicately tied spinner and swing it. Take these streamers and dead drift them. Take these nymphs and do crazy stuff with them. Give them slack. Give them weight. Just fish them in all different kinds of contortions and shapes and sizes. And you'll be pretty amazed at what you can do. And I think if you use something basic like a bird's nest, say I'm only going to fish with a bird's nest this week or this outing, you're going to learn some stuff. You're going to learn that presentation is a lot more important than you thought it was.
Okay. Let's close it off here. We've run out of time. Not run out of questions, that's for sure, but maybe we can have you back again, Ralph, and
sure.
We can revisit some things. But when we return, stick with us, folks, here, because in the next few minutes we're going to be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine, and we'll also be giving away copies of Ralph's book, Fish Food, courtesy of Stackpole Books, and a copy of one of his other books, The Sierra Trout Guide, that bestseller from Frank Amato Publications. So stick with us here a few more minutes, and we'll do those drawings and give those books away. Reeling and Healing Midwest is a nonprofit organization that champions fly fishing retreats for women surviving and battling all types of cancer. Their mission is to introduce women to the healing powers of the sport of fly fishing and provide a one-of-a-kind experience on and off the water. This is accomplished through the elements of fly fishing, positive camaraderie, peer coaching, nature, and a support network, which in turn renews the spirit and hope of each participant. Reeling and Healing Midwest is in need of trout, flies, waders, leaders, fishing equipment, and other items. To view their current wish list and to learn how you can support their retreats, visit www.reelingandhealingmidwest.org. That's reelingandhealingmidwest.org. Or call 866 866-237-5725. That's 866-237-5725. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find the link on our homepage in the section on tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'll really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away our prizes. And the first prize we're going to do the drawing for is for a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And if you're not familiar with the Federation of Fly Fishers, go out there and check them out. They're on www.fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. They're an international fly fishing organization that does a lot for us as fly fishers. So the winner of that one-year membership is going to be David Phillips in Michigan. David Phillips in Michigan. So congratulations, David, and I know you're going to enjoy your membership. If you're already a member, we'll get you extended for a year. So now we'll give away a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine, and Fly Fusion is a magazine out of Calgary, Canada. Excellent magazine, and a lot of how-tos. It's a magazine you'll learn a lot from, and you can find out more about Fly Fusion by going to www.flyfusionmag.com. That's www.flyfusionmag.com. And let's see here. Okay, finally. Okay, looks like Danny Buchanan in California. Danny Buchanan in California, and you just won a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So congratulations, Danny, on winning that subscription. I know you'll enjoy it. Well, now it's time to give away Ralph's books, so I'm going to need your help on this, Ralph. We're going to ask a question here, and we'll give the fish food book to the first winner, and the runner-up will get the Sierra Trout Guide. So that's how we'll work this tonight. And let me just make sure my queue is cleared here. And so the question is going to be a two-part question. Got to make it a little bit difficult for them. And one of the questions is, these are both about presentation. Early in the show, Ralph said that he would fish a grasshopper differently than we normally would fish a grasshopper on a stream. How does he fish it? And also, how would he fish a crayfish in a stream? Two-part questions. What would he do with a grasshopper, and how would he fish the crayfish? So we're making this kind of difficult tonight, but those are two great tips I think you gave away tonight. And so we'll see what comes in here. Okay, the first person that wrote in would be subsurface. So I guess he's saying both of them would be fish subsurface. Is that close enough or specific enough? Or do you want to look for another one?
That's half right. I mean, that's right, but I think it needs to be worked on a little bit.
Okay, the next one is underwater, and that's the same thing. Here's one, fish hopper subsurface dead drift crayfish.
Perfect.
That's it. And that's Christian in Asheville. So, Christian, congratulations. You won Ralph's book, Fish Food. I know you'll learn a lot and get a lot out of it. So, let's see. We've got to look for our runner-up. This one is just below the surface with weight for first question, and then two, let it hit the bottom and then rise.
No.
Okay. How about the first grasshopper with a split shot and dead drift the crayfish?
You got it. That's
okay,
it.
Okay, that's Jerry and Helena. So, Jerry, you won Ralph's book, Sierra Trout Guide. So congratulations. Now, both you gentlemen need to send me your contact information, your name, address, email address, and so forth. You can send that to info@askaboutflyfishing.com, or you can just put it in the box that you just answered the question in, and send it that to me that way so that we can get these publishers to send you the books directly. So do that for me, and we'll get those out to you. And thanks for playing, and thanks, Ralph, for being the judge. It's not always the fun job, you know.
Well, the right answers were very right.
Yeah, yeah, and that's what we were looking for, and I think those are two things that if you walk away from the show today and try both those things, you'd be catching more fish, and I think that's what it's all about. So, well, Ralph, thanks for being on the show with us tonight. It was a pleasure to talk with you, and thanks for taking your time out of your busy schedule to do this, and we really appreciate it, and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Well, thank you for having me. It was fun. It was easy. I'm honored. It was great.
Oh, great, great. Well, hopefully, like I said, we can maybe do something in the future and kind of explore some other things as we go down the road. So thanks again. On our next podcast, which will be on October 5th at 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, on that show we'll be interviewing Aaron Jasper again. And on this topic for this show is going to be New York City fly fishing, only a cab ride away. So New York City area is one of the most densely populated areas in the country. However, if one were to take a map, a pencil compass, and make a 90-mile circle around New York City, there are hundreds of high-quality fly fishing streams within this area. So join us as we take a tour of some of the great fisheries in New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania, all within a short drive of the Big Apple. We'd like to thank Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, the Orvis Company, Cortland Line, Royal Gorge Anglers, and Housatonic River Outfitters for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.